by one of my co-hosts,
Martin Corley.
And this week we're joined by a new guest. He's a first-time appearance, and I hope he's not too nervous. We have Adam Lowes from the very famous and prominent UK film blog, Hey You Guys, heyyouguys.co.uk. Hi, Adam.
Hey, you guys.
Hey, you guys.
That's me saying hey.
How's it going, Adam?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on board. I'm very excited.
Yeah, we get you on before you get really, really busy in your life, so I thought it was a good time to get all of your single activities out of the window.
No, it's great. I'm looking forward to it.
Cool. So, let's get the show started. We're a bit, we're not on the usual rhythm we have because Ahmed couldn't make it this time. He's out sick. So, send him your wishes when you're listening to this podcast. Hopefully, he'll be a lot better. So, our show schedule is a bit in disarray. But this week, we'll be talking about Super 8. The new J.J. Abrams movie, Captain America. We'll be talking about the new images of the new Superman that got released and Catwoman. And we'll also be talking about some of the new movies that Adam saw. So let's get the show started. Okay, guys, what should we start with? Should we start with Super 8?
Yeah, we do.
Let's get Super 8 out of the way, man. I want to really get into this. Like, I saw the movie, and okay, let's just start with general thoughts. Adam, what were your general thoughts on Super 8?
I might bring it down a little bit here, but I was a little bit disappointed, to be honest. I don't know about you guys, but I was a huge fan of J.J. Abrams' Star Trek.
Yeah.
Was that 2 years back? Wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
I mean, it was just great. It was a great sort of summer blockbuster. It was entertaining. It was, you know, he made those characters fresh again and someone you cared about. And I mean, I know that the characters are great, particularly the kids in Super 8, but I mean, I was kind of let down.
What about you, Marty?
I decided I was going to blank myself off from any kind of exposure to this film before I went to go and see it. So the only thing I'd seen were the TV spots, really. So I had no clue that essentially it's a kids' film. But in the end, I don't hold that against it, like I would do lots of other kids' films. I thought it was really good, and I got some distinct sort of like other film vibes throughout Super 8. And when I look at the other kind of stuff that J.J. Abrams has done, I mean, maybe we'll talk about that later, actually. But, I mean, just initially, yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I mean, this is quite interesting because, Adam, I think you and me being, like, proper film geeks in a way, not that we have any geek credentials, but we're very much kind of, you know, reading up on movies and being part of the whole marketing campaign that is kind of targeted at us. Super 8 had this massive teaser, sneaky kind of, you know, he was on Comic-Con, he presented like a small teaser. So I think maybe Martin was the smartest of us that he missed all of that and he just went blank into the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of odd because, like you said, the marketing was it's been running for a few months now and it was kind of secretive. And, you know, up until the first trailer, no one was really sure what it was. It was kind of a period film with sci-fi elements. Mm. And, just watching the film, it's kind of, I don't know why they kind of did that initial mystery because it's, you know, there's nothing, to be honest, there's nothing about it that kind of, there's nothing wrong with it in particular. It's quite well made. It's well made and everything, but it's kind of a standard sort of coming of age sci-fi thriller. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing in it that would suggest beforehand that there was this kind of big mystery to unravel and unearth. I don't know what you guys think.
I don't know if you guys have seen J.J. Abrams. He did this long interview. I think it was a TED Talk on TED.com that, you know, that, and he was talking about the mystery inside the box. And that J.J. Abrams, he's always interested in kind of creating a mystery. And he's done this with movies like Cloverfield, which he doesn't direct, but he was producer on it. Lost being a good example on it. He kind of creates this mystery And he's not always interested in how the mystery is solved. He's more interested about the intrigue surrounding the mystery. And I think he did a lot of that with Super 8. And I think what you're saying, Adam, is completely right. I don't think it's necessary for this movie. I wouldn't call it a kid's movie that Martin is saying. It's a movie with kids that doesn't necessarily make it a kid's movie. I do feel that JJ has that thing where he's more sometimes interested in the intrigue he creates surrounding the movie than the movie itself. And I think that might be one of the things that a lot of people have kind of been disappointed with Super 8. And maybe, Marty, you had nothing of that, so you were actually pleasantly surprised.
I think I'll pick up on a couple of things there. I think it's interesting what you say about it not really being a kids' film. It just has kids in. I think when I talk about it as being a kids' film, there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that it's got kids in. I think that's a fairly legitimate point to make. The children and the kids, they're pretty much, they are the focus of the film. You know, everything revolves around them. And I just think it's generally easier for people of their age to relate to them than it is people of our age, say. But I think the other thing which
Marty, is this one of those Martin rules where any movie with kids is a kids movie? Like any movie with a dragon sucks? Is that the kind of same kind of rule we're working?
I'm not applying a rule in this instance. Okay. I'm not applying a rule.
Otherwise, I'm going to Google some examples of kids movies with kids that really aren't kids movies, like Children of the Corn or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you could do that, or you could. But what I'm saying is that the core cast are children who are like 13, I guess. Yeah. I guess that's how old they are, something like that. But the other thing that I was going to say that also made me think about it being a kids' film is that when Adam mentioned that he didn't quite get into sort of like the actors themselves or really sort of necessarily have that much concern for them or whatever, I do agree with you, and I think maybe that's why I also felt that it was a kids' film, as in I can't actually... I mean, I wouldn't have minded if any of them died.
Oh my god.
I mean, I wouldn't have been, you know, that wouldn't have made me cry. I mean, I didn't sort of...
That's because you're a robot.
No, but I mean, I didn't feel such an emotional bond with any of those characters.
Right.
I mean, it is, obviously, it's a film made for like kids and family, but it's also a film for kind of my era, in the way it kind of harks back to that sort of 80s Amblin Spielberg way of storytelling. But the kids themselves, I mean, I actually quite liked the kids. I thought they were nice, and I like the kind of film within the film which they were filming. But for me, it kind of falls apart when the alien is introduced,
right?
A bit later on, and that's the issue that I've got with the film. Because I mean, I don't know if you know this, but originally it was two separate scripts that he wrote, and one was just like a normal sort of coming of age drama of these kids shooting this film, you know, where they kind of fall in out of love with whatever, and the other one was like a more straightforward sort of sci-fi about these soldiers transporting this alien cargo from Area 55. That's right, isn't it, Area 55? And yeah. And he kind of meshed them together to create, you know, the Super 8 that we see. And I don't think that really works, to be honest. I think it may have worked if I don't know how he would have done it, but it just, the two sort of diverse ideas don't really come together, and that's the problem I've got with it. I mean, I love all the kids stuff,
yeah,
but it is the sort of the sci-fi angle, surprisingly, that doesn't really work for me.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I mean, that's, now that you said that it was two scripts that were kind of like melded into one, I can completely understand that. That makes perfect sense that it was two kind of different stories. And one of the things I was thinking was, initially at least, I didn't, for a good few scenes, I didn't realize that it was set in the 80s for a start. But I was kind of getting different vibes. Like, I had a bit of, oh, this could go and be sort of like a Goonies kind of thing. And it'll just be about the kids kind of like going off and investigating it and solving the mystery for themselves and la-di-da-di-da. And then I was also thinking, when it became apparent that it was a bit more sci-fi-ish, then I kind of got an E.T. kind of vibe from it as well. And I think for me, the film worked best when there wasn't so much evidence as to what the alien was or even what it looked like. I was more happy that it was just this kind of like creepy thing that was potentially just abducting and killing people, and you didn't actually know what it was, where it was living, or any of that kind of background to it. So yeah, I everything Adam said then, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
Sorry.
I mean, this movie is clearly like seeped in nostalgia, you know? It's not only set in the 80s, but it really makes us want to think of E.T., Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Goonies even, like you mentioned. But it takes us back to this time of, you know, like white suburbia in America where there were no black neighbors. I think I only saw two colored people in the entire movie. But I think it kind of wants to have its cake and eat it too, you know? Like that scene where, you know, that scene with the Walkman where he was like explaining what a Walkman was? It's like a personal stereo, you know, and I just felt that was then a bit too much on the nose, you know. That's like, what are they trying to do? It has no punchline. It's not going anywhere with that joke. But then again, I was thinking maybe I'm just that age that I still know what a Walkman is, because I actually don't remember Super 8 movies. That was before my time, I think. I never had a Super 8 camera. I've never used them or anything like that. So maybe people that are 6-7 years younger than me haven't ever seen a Walkman. So I don't know. But I do feel that it kind of uses our nostalgia a bit too much in this.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's my kind of other issue with it as well. It's hard to kind of see Abrams' kind of directorial style coming through, really, because it is so much of a sort of homage to that period. I mean, you know, there's some nice stuff in there. I mean, I like, is it the director Charles? He's kind of, you know, he's got this kind of frantic sort of multiple kid environment household.
Yeah.
You know, when he's got like,
yeah.
Got sort of 15, 16 like brothers and sisters, you know, it's just manic and stuff. And that's very sort of Spielbergian, you know, particularly kind of Poltergeist and E.T. and stuff. Yeah. And that's really nice, but you know, the film becomes kind of, it's like an homage without kind of seeing any of the director's sort of own style coming through. And even the score by Michael Giacchino, he's a regular, he did Lost, he did like Star Trek, he's done some Pixar stuff. I mean, that most of that's pretty much nut for nut John Williams as well.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, you've got this film that doesn't, you know, the whole idea of sort of postmodernism and sort of nods back to that era and stuff is just, you know, you want to see something else, something new coming through and something fresh at the same time, and you don't really get that.
Yeah.
You don't really get that.
I think it's also just the ghost of the name that's attached to it. You have J.J. Abrams, but you have Steven Spielberg, you know? And you just always keep wondering, how much did Steven Spielberg have to do with this movie, you know? Is it just an homage to Spielberg, or did he actually kind of sit down with Abrams and kind of, you know? I don't know how they made it, but it does seem like a mishmash of styles, a mishmash of scripts, and a lot of nostalgia poured over it, especially for geeks and fanboys, and like, here's it all served on a plate, and I hope you enjoy it. But I want to kind of get back to the marketing campaign of it, because it actually started, I think, last year already in Comic-Con. They showed a bit, snippets of the Super 8 movie that they were shooting. But, how do you guys feel about that? Because we, this movie came out in, I mean, the 5th of August in the US, in the UK, and it came out in June in the US. So that's 3 months later. So, I mean, that's a very big disconnect in terms of marketing, where they create all of this, you know, like mystery in the box kind of thing, and then we have to wait 3 months to watch the movie. I just feel that's kind of a shame.
Yeah, it's an odd one, because, I mean, normally nowadays, regardless of marketing or not, they kind of want to close that and release window down between sort of American and UK release, you know, dates, because obviously piracy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's an odd one. I mean, I suppose it is more kind of, obviously, like, the US is their sort of the core audience they're going after and stuff. I don't know. I don't know why they decided to do that at all. I mean, I've talked to people about it, and no one seems to have like a sort of solid answer.
Yeah, it's a shame, I feel.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's. I'm trying to think. I mean, the Cowboys and Aliens. I think there was about 2 or 3 weeks, but yeah, I mean, this is like, I haven't seen a film of this scope have.
Such
a sort of. Space between
staggered release.
It's an odd one.
Yeah.
And like you say, it does kill. I know it does kind of kill that initial sort of mystery, doesn't it, for sort of European viewers or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, like if they are I mean, this movie can only be successful with our target audience. You know, film geeks, people that grew up with 80s movies. So if they're gonna spend that much money on marketing. I mean, with the internet and stuff like that, I just feel it's just like such a big disconnect with the audience that they're trying to go after. Especially when, I mean, I follow a lot of American blogs and film blogs and stuff like that, and I was already getting a lot of mediocre reviews out of it, that it's not as great as they thought, and a lot of people were disappointed by it. So I had already set my expectations kind of low going into the movie. But I mean, I did actually kind of enjoy it, and I think a big part of that was, like you guys mentioned, was the kids in the movie. I just think they did an awesome job casting these kids, and the performances they did, especially the kind of Romeo and Juliet kind of vibe that they had going on between Joe Lamb and Alice. That was the core of the movie for me. I don't know, Marty, was that something that you connected with?
No, I really liked them. I just felt that it was more the way that the film went meant that I didn't have that kind of... I wouldn't have had my guts wrenched out of me if one of them had died, you know. Which I guess is either down to the director or the writing or both. But no, I thought the girl was really good. And I did like... I did like the lead kid boy,
Joel Courtney.
The kids are great in it, and especially that first scene which introduces them all, where before the train crash and the shooting, that sort of that dialogue by the old train station. I mean, that's really beautiful, and it's kind of sad that the film doesn't really kind of it doesn't follow it up really with that similar sort of emotion and sort of wonder for the rest of it. But I mean, it's Elle Fanning, isn't it? Dakota's little sister, who was really good at, I don't know if you've seen somewhere, the Sofia Coppola film, but she's really good.
Oh, I didn't realise it was her sister.
It's the first movie I've seen with her, I think.
She's great. And the film, that kind of, I don't know, have you guys seen Mulholland Drive, the David Lynch film?
Yeah.
It's got that rehearsal, and then sort of the shooting scene. It kind of echoes a scene from that with Naomi Watts, where she does this rehearsal for this part in Mulholland Drive. She's an actress, and you know, she comes across first of all kind of all innocent and kind of fair, and then the sort of rehearsal, and she's kind of, you know, she's like this sort of vamp. She's completely different to what you'd expect. And it kind of works, obviously. Fanny's not this, some kind of like vamp that's got her eyes on them all, but it kind of works. It works a similar sort of notion there, where, you know, she just totally brings the scene alive when the camera's rolling. It's really beautiful, that, and I just didn't get a sense of that for the rest of the film. So
I think it's, I mean, the way they shoot it is like Joe falls in love with her at that moment, right? And I think we as an audience do too.
Totally. I mean, it's you know, he really sells it to you, that.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say about the you were saying about the sort of Romeo and Juliet angle. What do you think about the kind of adults in this film? Because I think particularly his dad, who's played by, is it Carl Chandler?
Carl Chandler, yeah.
That, I mean, his character doesn't go anywhere really, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
he kind of, you know, he, in a sense, he's the same as the kids at first. He's trying to uncover this mystery for himself. You know, he keeps getting sort of pushed away by the army general or whatever. And then his kind of story arc, his character arc, whatever, he just follows it's very sort of one-dimensional, and it doesn't really factor into the story. You know, it doesn't really push the story.
No, it goes nowhere whatsoever.
It's odd.
It doesn't. All it does is he just realizes that he made a small mistake and that he learns to forgive the guy, and that's pretty much it. I think with both of the parents, actually, both of the main parents who are in it, for them, I think the film is just, it's about them realizing that they made a mistake, and then they effectively forgive each other, and that,
yeah, which isn't too,
seems to be it, really.
Yeah, it's not very kind of gripping or anything, is it?
And the other thing is, the issues that I had with it, I mean, I have to say, I felt that the performances were great, but the characters were just horribly written. Both the dads, and the problem was with that, the whole kind of the crux of the story, the forgiving each other, there wasn't that much to forgive. I mean, the guy just, I mean, it wasn't his fault that the mom had died, right? I mean, he just kind of slept and he didn't go to his job, and it's not, he didn't create the explosion or anything like that, you know? I mean, what is there that much to forgive? And I felt the whole struggle that Kyle Chandler's character had almost felt something from the 50s instead of the 80s. You know what I mean? He was like this dad that was completely out of touch with his child, and he was this almost like a black and white kind of view over the world. Maybe because he's a cop, but that's normally what cops do, I assume. I don't know any cops. But I just felt that it was almost like Kevin's dad in the Wonder Years more than something in the 80s. I don't know if you guys agree with that.
Yeah, it's an odd kind of position to have him as a character.
Yeah,
but I think it's a symptom of like we talked about the two sort of the two different scripts coming together. You know, I mean, it'd be interesting to see where the sort of dad characters sat in the other scripts, if it was the same or he had to kind of alter it to sort of shoehorn them in, really.
Yeah, I think they got the remnant of another story. Pretty much, they were the bridge between the two stories, and it doesn't gel well, I feel. And I think we were talking about that one scene at the train station. Straight after that, we go into what J.J. Abrams has now really become known for, and it's a huge train crash. I mean, who the hell transports a living alien with, like, tons of explosives? Like, how is that even logical? Like, that wasn't that, like, the biggest train explosion you've ever seen?
The train explosion was too big. I was sat there just thinking, this is... I mean, I'm not exactly one for picking up sort of, like, continuity, not that it's a continuity error, but I don't generally nitpick at films and say, oh, you wouldn't do that in real life, that wouldn't happen in real life. Honestly, that train wreck would not have happened in real life. It was very unrealistic. It was, like, real in the sense of what it depicted was realistic, but no way would a train crash like that and send carriages, like, shooting 50 feet up into the air and
then explosions all that kind of... That's crazy.
That was too much. I was just going to say, the other thing that was unrealistic about the train crash as well was the fact that the scientist was actually alive in his partly dented car. Basically, Armageddon had been unleashed around him, and the train was basically supposed to have run him over. Unless I missed something, but I don't know.
He survived. The guy just survived.
But again, it's kind of...
He's been murdered in hospital. Sorry, that was a spoiler.
Spoiler. No, I mean, yeah, you're totally right. But again, the strength of the sort of the performance, the kids' performers, I mean, they're really kind of... You really buy them in that circumstance, don't you? They're kind of throwing up afterwards, you know, they're just screaming for their lives. I mean, they really help to sell the scene, but yeah, it's huge.
And, I mean, I don't want to be, like, racist for a second or anything like that, but didn't you think when you saw him in the car completely crashed up, that it was Jeffrey from The Fresh Prince? I was like, hey, it's Jeffrey! Jeffrey caused the car crash.
My gosh.
I'm trying to look
for... Do you know who he was? Sorry, what are you saying?
I was just going to say, if we're going on lookalikes, then honestly, the dad, he looks like one of the Bridges brothers.
In the younger years, I mean,
yeah.
But do you know who the professor is? The guy in the car?
No.
I did my sort of detective geek work. He's
from The Wire.
He's the dude. He's in The Wire.
Yeah.
But he's also the science teacher from Gremlins. You know, the one who...
Really?
Yeah, the one he tries to feed it, doesn't it? And it grabs his arm. And then, so you know, that's obviously a sort of nod to that, because like Gremlins is a Amblin film, isn't it?
Yeah, the actor's name is Glyn Turman, and yeah, he's the mayor in The Wire. So that's where we know him from. I think I wouldn't have remembered the Gremlins, but yeah, I definitely know him from The Wire, where he plays Mayor Clarence Royce. And he looks a lot like Jeffrey.
He's a bad man.
Yeah, but that train crash. I mean, didn't it feel like he just superimposed the plane crash from Lost, and he used like instead of like plane wreckage, he used like train parts.
I don't remember watching the plane crash in Lost. I think it was a complete waste of time anyway.
Dude, how can he say that?
But he does that with his films. He likes to open big because he's, you know, you've got the kind of the destruction of the Enterprise in Star Trek. You've got the sort of attack in Cloverfield. You've got the big Mission Impossible's got that big sort of action scene, hasn't it, at the beginning where they go and rescue.
Well, the start is where he's going to almost shoot Tom Cruise. He always does these cold opens, and I just call it the J.J. Abrams opening, actually. I don't know what the filmic word for it is, but I just call it a J.J. Abrams opening, you know?
He just... A J.J.
He's pulling a J.J. So, guys, what did you think about the alien? I mean, we haven't really spoken about that. I mean, I felt the design was very close to the Cloverfield alien, actually. And I actually thought, is this like what happened before Cloverfield? He got really pissed off and he ended in Manhattan, or what happened? I just felt it was exactly the same monster. I don't know about you guys.
Go on,
Adam. Go on. No, you got him.
I just think there's kind of, in the last sort of few years in Hollywood, it's the kind of Independence Day syndrome, isn't it? There's a real lack of sort of imagination when it comes to aliens in the sort of the big fantasy films. And it was, for me, and this was the most worrying part, it looked like, I put this in my review as well, it looked like someone had sort of wandered into the design department for Transformers and like picked up a discarded piece of like paper with like sketches on for a Transformer and kind of just like coloured it in, give it like a flesh and blood kind of makeover, and then stuck it in that film, because it was, you know, it wasn't terrifying or anything, and it didn't, even when you kind of, another spoiler obviously, but even when you see it kind of up close and personal, you know, you never get that sense of like, you're not scared of it or anything like that, and it does look a little bit like a Transformer, especially like around the face and the mouth area.
Yeah.
So it's weird. I would have thought that they would have, they'd want to get, you know, make a unique alien that would kind of stand out at the very least, but...
Yeah. Marty, you were saying?
I mean, my thing with the alien, I agree with you there on the sort of, just like the lack of imagination when it comes to these things recently. And I think I'll actually go back to what I said earlier, in that I was more sort of intrigued when you couldn't really tell what it looked like. Yeah. And it was just doing random stuff like knocking over police cars and sucking up metal and body snatching and doing, you know, when you saw the results of what the alien was doing and you caught just sort of like glimpses of it kind of like scuttling around or climbing up a side of a fence or something, that I thought was really good. And I thought if they had just sort of, I think maybe if they just had enough bottle to just kind of like run with the fact that you're only going to get glimpses of it, then I thought that could actually be more effective than just, in the end, it was sort of like a cross between the big kind of spider monster that's at the end of Stephen King's It film. I was thinking, oh God, it's just basically a big spider. So I thought immediately of Stephen King's It. And then I was thinking, and then I couldn't really, it was just, in the end, it was just a bit, oh, you're not actually, not actually that terrifying, because it wasn't sort of like drooling in saliva and sort of like spitting acid and doing all that kind of stuff. But I think it was a little bit, I don't know, I almost felt that the way, when you get to the end of the film, you see how the film ends and you sort of work back from that and you realize that I think that they had to kind of do something where the alien was more visible at some point, because there is that scene when he's talking to the to the kid, and that's when it all becomes a bit, you know, you've got to give the alien human characteristics and the human kind of emotions, because that's the way that the film ends, and that's the natural sort of like denouement of it.
I was going to say that's
I mean, I'm done. So
that's a big problem with the ending as well. This is pretty much spoilers, isn't it, for the whole thing? So
yeah, we're in spoiler section. Anyone's listening? Typical you podcast. We end up in spoilers without telling anybody. We're in spoilers, guys. So yeah, go ahead.
But you know, the end's obviously meant to kind of hark back to the ending of E.T.
Yeah.
And you know, whereas the ending of E.T., you know, for starters, it's a completely different sort of setup for the alien. So you've got this, there's this big emotional payoff at the end of E.T. And Abrams trying to like go for that same kind of idea with this one, but it doesn't work, because, you know, it's kind of, obviously the alien here is a sort of killing machine or whatever. No, the alien here is obviously, it's out to kind of, it wants to go home as well. It's the same as E.T., I suppose, in that sense. It wants to go home. But, you know, we're not talking about some kind of friendly, sort of awkward, bumbling alien that's, like, builds a genuine sort of rapport and love with the lead character and thing. It's just an alien that wants to go home that ends up killing people in the process and stealing, you know, chasing away dogs. And so this big emotional sort of scene at the end where the spaceship leaves and stuff, I mean, it just doesn't work.
But, you know, it suffers kind of from that old adage of movies where they say you should show us, not tell us. And I think that's one of the problems with the aliens. They basically tell us four times, oh, it's this super sensitive being that makes an emotional bond when it touches you. But we see none of that in the movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The professor is saying, oh, it's such a fragile beast that can do so much for us, but we've tortured him into this monster. Okay, we don't see any of that. Elle Fanning says the same thing. Oh, I could feel what he was thinking. Okay, you feel it, but maybe take some effort to connect with the audience and not just with the characters in the movie, you know, and just telling us that apparently there's this big emotional connection. And you're right, I think they were trying to kind of balance that line between making it a threat and making the monster kind of angry and threatening, but also making that emotional connection and then jumping over to E.T. territory. And I think it was just lazy filmmaking in a way, because neither the character design was well done. It wasn't shot well. Even in the scene in the cave, you couldn't really make out what was going on. And the other thing I felt was really lazy, the sense of proportion of the monster. Did you guys have any idea how big it was or how small it was? Because sometimes it was attacking a whole bus, and then it couldn't get into the bus, but then it was in this cave, and then it just kind of skirted up buildings. I just had no sense of how big is this monster. Is it like a 6-foot giant, an 8-foot giant, or is it like Cloverfield, where it's like 3-4 stories high. I didn't know.
Yeah, it's a little bit difficult to kind of work out.
Somewhere in between those two extremes, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Is my conclusion. But it wasn't massively apparent. But.
Yeah, I just thought it was kind of badly done. And then the other thing that really also annoyed me is just kind of... I mean, I know the army is kind of a go-to bad guy, you know? Except if it's a Michael Bay movie, then they're like, America, fuck yeah. But otherwise, army is usually a cliche bad guy. But here, they just had no motivation. They didn't explain anything. I mean, I watched this movie with my wife, and when we came out, and she was like, why were they chasing that white Rubik's Cube? I mean, they didn't even really explain that Rubik's Cube kind of thing was the alien ship or whatever, you know? They should show, like, this small cutscene. But again, it's just... it's just kind of a waste of what the movie could have been, you know. I would have loved if they just focused on the children, it's just kind of a shame that they didn't.
Yeah, he should have stuck with the first script.
Yeah. So, any final words, guys, on Super 8? Adam or Marty?
The only thing I was going to say was. It's a good film. Give it 6 out of 10.
Yeah. You would recommend people go watch it?
Yeah, but I say that knowing nothing else about whatever else is on at the cinema right now.
That's awesome, dude.
it's like a blind recommendation.
It's a hugely blind recommendation. Right. I mean, maybe you could go and see Troll Hunter instead.
Yeah, I want to see that.
That's probably a bit more freaky and scary, and more action. But the other thing I was going to say is that when you were at the end, and I'm assuming that you both sat there and watched the full little Super 8 film that the kids directed,
yeah,
and starred in.
The Case.
Did you see that it was? You what?
It's called The Case.
Oh, The Case. Sorry, yeah, that's right. But did you see that it was Romero? Chemicals.
Yeah, I did see that.
Good.
Nice little nod. But you know, again, they show that at the end, and it's kind of like you're watching that, and it's genuinely like funny and kind of charming and stuff. And you're like, well, I kind of wanted more of this throughout, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I'm with Martin in terms of like recommendations. I mean, I called it an average 6. Bit of pun in there somewhere. But it's not a bad film, but it's just not the film of the summer.
Yeah,
and I know you talked about looking at some sites, like American sites, sort of saying it was average. But I kind of found the opposite. There's a lot of American sites that were kind of bigging it up and, you know, like full of hyperbole. And I think maybe they're a bit more kind of biased, maybe.
Yeah,
because it's kind of, you know, it's part of their sort of folklore or whatever. You know, it's real sort of Americana film. And I think the sort of critics that I've listened to in this country and read, I think they've got a sort of a better sort of clearer view of the film. So I suppose it's worth seeing, but yeah, just it's not the film that I expected or wanted. So it was a disappointment.
Yeah, I mean, in my case, I think I liked it a bit more than you guys did. Maybe I was hard on it during the review, but I did enjoy the movie while I was watching it. It didn't really... So yeah, I just felt it didn't fulfill the promise that it kind of created with the team attached with it, J.J. Abrams directing, kind of having this nostalgia feel to it. But it's still... It's kind of a good time. Go watch it for the kids' performance, which is great. And everything to do with the kids is great. The movie that they make at the end of it is probably the best part of the movie. It's beautifully shot. I mean, you have to say that the cinematography of Super 8 is really crisp. It's very clean, and there's not even that many lens flares. So I know people complain a lot about J.J. Abrams, that there's a lot of lens flares. I only caught 3.
So you're running an unofficial lens flare count.
Oh, people are running a lens flare count with J.J. Abrams movies. So there's only 3 that I counted, so that's okay. I mean, in my mind, it again, like you said, Adam, for us cold-hearted Europeans and Brits, maybe it doesn't pull at our heartstrings as much as E.T. did, for example. Although I've never been a huge fan of E.T. Probably because I'm not... my parents are happily married. They weren't divorced or anything like that. So I think at least E.T.
Are you trying to suggest that you have to be a product of a broken home to kind of dig E.T.?
Yeah, I do.
I think that's what Asim's saying, actually.
Dude,
let me tell you, sir. My parents are happily married as well, and I thoroughly enjoyed the film when I was a kid. How old were you when you saw it?
The thing is, I never got it. I never got E.T. I was always an Indiana Jones fan more than anything. But like the whole period of where Spielberg is trying to get over his personal demons, that's not really the Spielberg I liked. I liked the Spielberg that gave me Indiana Jones, basically.
Yeah, Jaws and whatnot. I mean, I saw E.T. once. I think I was 12. That's it.
Really? I think I saw it at the cinema when it first came out, so I must have been kind of... 6, 7.
Yeah,
plus, I was quite young.
Maybe I do feel E.T. was probably liking or loving E.T. because there's not people don't like E.T. They love E.T. You know, I think it does say something about kind of the kind of how you grew up and the kind of background you had. I don't know.
See, but none of us are immune from our generalizations, Asim.
Okay, so let's move on to our next topic then. Captain America? Since we are talking about nostalgic movies, maybe we can talk about it like in quickly 10 minutes, because Marty didn't get a chance to see it. But Marty, are you still planning to go see Captain America?
I think so, yeah. I'd like to. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that is really good to see in the cinema, and... As I mentioned in other podcasts, I'm a bit of a sucker for pretty much anything that's a comic book or a cartoon sort of adaptation. I'll nip to the Clapham Picture House and watch it probably.
Especially if we've seen the worst of the kinds, then you have to see kind of the best of the kind. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it does fall into that category. It's a lot of fun, isn't it? I really enjoyed it.
So yeah, I mean, Adam, what were your general thoughts about Captain America? I think let's not spoil it because Marty hasn't seen it, although he knows the story because we reviewed the Albert Pune version in episode 31 or 30.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, we did that. The things we do for our audience.
Yeah, I mean, we really watch them so that you don't have to.
Yeah. So he understands the basic premise of the story of a weak soldier that gets injected by the super serum and then becomes Captain America, fights for truth, liberty, and American way, or is that Superman? Adam, what were your general thoughts on Captain America?
I really enjoyed it. I think for me, I mean, we're coming to the end of the summer season, really, but for me, the kind of this one and X-Men are my favourites, really, the two comic book adaptations.
Yeah.
Which isn't difficult, is it? Because it's just like chock full of them at this summer. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. It looks great. It's an origin story, obviously, but it's just really well told, and you've got the kind of, it doesn't, some people saying that it kind of flags around the sort of hour mark, but I never found that as well. I really like the kind of montage sequences when he kind of, you know, he becomes Captain America and he's kind of, you know, he's this propaganda machine. Mm. It's just great. I mean, Chris Evans is fantastic. Playing it pretty straight, to be honest.
Yeah.
Considering how he was in something like, you know, playing was it Johnny Storm? His name in Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
It's completely what the character needed. But yeah, he's great. I mean, and you know, a great supporting cast. People are kind of not comparing it to Thor, but they're kind of saying it's sort of equal footing, or that they like Thor more. But I mean, for me, Captain America kind of comes up top. I mean, did you enjoy it as much as me? Or?
I did. I mean, I know, like, again, when you compare it to what happened in the States, people were like loving this movie. I liked it maybe a little less, but I still think it's probably one of the best superhero movies out there. Almost on par with Iron Man. It's that good. And I find it really interesting that, I mean, my worry was about this whole setup was Joe Johnston, the director. And I think they did something very similar to what they did with Thor, is that Kenneth Branagh, coming out of this theatrical Shakespearean background, they added a lot of that in Thor. And Joe Johnston, coming from this schmaltzy Americana kind of background, especially from his movie The Rocketeer, they used a lot of that in Captain America. But they just make it a very kind of cohesive movie, which, being even an origin movie, isn't really boring. And I think it's just because of the performances in there, and Marvel just has a really good handle of what they want to make these characters do. And I think it's probably good for this movie that they have an end game. You know, they have the Avengers movie, so they know where they want to go. So they kind of have all these movies that are building towards something. And I think Captain America was a very important component of that Avengers story. And now we're ready for it. You know, we're all lubed up. We're completely ready to go. bring it on, man. I'm fully on board for the Avengers. And I really, really loved Captain America. And also for female listeners, it has a very, it has very strong female performances by Hayley Atwell, who's a British actress, isn't she?
Yeah. No, she's great as well. And it's kind of, because obviously she's the sort of intended love interest, but it's kind of nice how the play, because he's kind of this, you know, he's kind of straight-laced, all-American type, but he's really not too great when it comes to the women, even though he's like this big heroic character now.
Yeah.
And she's really nice, and she kind of, it's a nice kind of counterbalance to him, because she's quite sort of strong-willed. And I think he's kind of, she scares him a little bit, even though he is Captain America.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's good. But I just wanted to talk about what you said about Marvel as well. I mean, they've done a great job, and I'm sure there must have been, like, because obviously they've got the Marvel Studios now, as opposed to kind of working. Well, they're still co-distribute or whatever. But yeah, I mean, Joe Johnson and Kenneth Branagh, I mean, the directors for hire, but you know, Marvel know what they're doing with them. You know, and I think to a certain extent they can probably kind of, there's a bit of sculpting going on there within Marvel. You know, the directors themselves have to sort of surrender themselves to that world. But yeah, I mean, it's, again, I wasn't particularly kind of enamored when I found out that he was directing it. But you know, you watch something like the Rocketeer, which is, you know, it's 20 year old now, but yeah, it's definitely got that kind of retro sheen that film has as well, and you know, and it's a lot of fun like that.
Yeah, and so. Yeah, and just kind of the world that they create in that movie is just it's so beautiful, you know, like the photography, the action is really good, although it's not heavy on action. The scenes that are in there, and especially just the whole becoming Captain America scenes are just awesome, you know, how he kind of discovers his powers. And I like what you said, that he pretty much is a good guy, and even after becoming a Captain America, he still is a good guy, you know. And I really think that Chris Evans really sells that, and I'm glad for Chris Evans, because he kind of pulls off what poor Ryan Reynolds wasn't able to do in Green Lantern. Or he didn't get a chance. I think his performance in Green Lantern was great, but that movie wasn't able to make him the superhero that we wanted him to be, you know. And but Chris Evans is completely convincing as Captain America. And I think it's his fourth or fifth comic book movie, isn't it?
Yeah, he's done a few. He's done a few.
Yeah,
but I also love the fact that. This isn't particularly a spoiler, but I love the fact sort of when he turns into Captain America and kind of got him back on the home front sort of rallying the troops in America and stuff. There's actually a musical kind of montage number, which is great. And, you know, you see him kind of in these old sort of serial films playing Captain America, and it's great. And you know, there's the one shot where he's kind of, I think they've got the, you know, it's like a kind of cheap Hollywood serial film, so they've got the kind of, I think they've got the background, there's a fake background that's being sort of, that's running across, and he's kind of walking down, and the director's just screaming at him, saying, "Don't look at the camera, don't look at the camera." And I think that sums up perfectly, like, his kind of, his frustration in that situation, because, you know, he's not this film star or anything. He's, you know, he's not this face of, like, America's, well, he's the face of, like, America battling the sort of evil, but he, you know, he wants to get out there and sort of do what he was designed for.
Yeah.
And it's just, it captures, you know, the little moments like that really capture the character.
Yeah, no, it's really good, but, yeah, and also, like I said, the Avengers kind of skeleton surrounding it isn't heavy-handed, you know? Like, not like in Iron Man 2, where it really felt kind of...
In terms of what?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you're a huge fan of Iron Man 2. I wasn't. I loved the first one. The second one, I felt, had a lot of problems in it. It felt almost like Jon Favreau was overpowered by the Avengers machinery and where they wanted to kind of take it.
Oh, definitely.
And it felt that they forcibly inserted all these Avengers references, where I felt in Captain America it was really organic.
Yeah, I mean, in closing, no, definitely, I mean, I think out of the kind of the sort of pre-Avenger films, this one definitely felt the kind of, you know, it didn't let any of that stuff get in the way of the storytelling, which is important, you know, because you don't want it, you don't want the films to appear as like one kind of long advert for the Avengers, you know, you want to kind of, they need to stand alone, you know, they need to exist without that, so yeah, definitely. Cool.
Yeah, so I think we all, I mean, both of us really enjoyed Captain America, and I'm sure, Marty, you will too when you get a chance to catch up with it.
No, for sure.
Okay, so let's move on to, we received this article from one of our Twitter friends, Robert Lee and Kay Matthews from totallyfilmy.com. Awesome guys on Twitter, you should follow them. And they tweeted this article called 30 Harshest Filmmaker on Filmmaker Insults in History. It's from flavorwire.com. You should check it out. It's pretty much, I mean, it's what we do, you know. This is what geeks do. We diss filmmakers. We kind of disrespect one filmmaker. We hate the other filmmaker. And I mean, basically, these are the discussions me and Marty have on a weekly basis, where Marty will be like, "Oh, this Ingmar Bergman movie was awesome, and this Orson Welles," and I'm like, "Dude, I just want like a kung fu movie. What are you talking about?" You know, so. It was kind of interesting to get this, where it's filmmakers dissing other filmmakers. So I just kind of thought it was funny that it was interesting to see Truffaut take on Michelangelo Antonio, and Bergman taking on Orson Welles, and Spike Lee taking on Quentin Tarantino. So, I mean, Marty, did you have a chance to look at the article?
Yeah, I read all of them actually. I have some favorites. I quite like the I quite like the Orson Welles on Jean-Luc Godard. His gifts as a director are enormous. I just can't take him very seriously as a thinker, and that's where we seem to differ, because he does. His message is what he cares about these days, and like most movie messages, it could be written on the head of a pin. You know, but there are some to do with Tarantino that I quite like, because I've been prone to diss Tarantino recently. But
up with that, man? What's up with you dissing Tarantino, man? He's the voice of a generation.
Sounds like a Pepsi ad.
Yeah.
I was actually referencing South Park with that Kanye West episode.
Oh God.
He's a genius.
But it's a good list actually. This, I like it.
Yeah. Adam, man, which one did stand out, or do you agree? I mean, that's kind of what it is, right? I mean, we tend to like the disses that we agree with, right?
I think it's kind of funny because all the older directors on the list, that, you know, they're really quite eloquent with the disses, and you know, they're really quite they're funny and they're well thought out. And then you've got someone like Vincent Gallo, who just calls Sophie Coppola a fat pig. You know, it's like put some effort into it, Vincent.
But yeah, I mean, Gallo is known for being kind of like, out there, you know, he's like a very indulgent guy. I mean, anybody that makes an actress like give him fellatio for like 10 minutes in his own movie, dude, like seriously, who the hell are you to kind of talk about like Coppola and Scorsese and Spike Jonze, you know what I mean?
Yeah, he likes to provocate, doesn't he? He loves that. But I liked David Gordon Green's, director David Gordon Green. What he said about Kevin Smith being, what did he say? He was like Special Olympics director.
He kind of created a Special Olympics for
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
They just kind of lowered the standard. I'm sure their parents are proud. It's just nothing I care to buy a ticket for.
I mean, that's beautiful. That's beautiful.
It is. But come on, man. Like, picking on Kevin Smith, it's like picking on the fat kid from class, man. I don't know. I just feel you shouldn't do that. He's one of us more than anybody, you know? And that's what I feel with Quentin Tarantino, Kevin Smith. I don't like people dissing on him because I feel they're one of us, you know? They're film geeks that made these awesome movies. And although I'm kind of bigging up myself more than anybody by saying they're one of us, but I just kind of like these guys, you know? And I just, yeah, like, for me, the hardest one is when Quentin Tarantino and Spike Lee got it on with each other in the Pulp Fiction era. And it was specifically about the usage of N-words in a script.
Yeah, well, that's a kind of different diss, isn't it? I think it was more Jackie Brown, wasn't it, that he sort of objected to slightly. Yeah. But that's a different kind of diss. That's kind of Spike Lee, you know, again, much like Vincent Gallo, he likes to kind of throw the cat amongst the pigeons, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But because. I have a feeling for Spike Lee. I mean, I do love him as a filmmaker, but I've got a feeling it's more kind of. I think he likes the kind of publicity and the kind of drama he creates. You know, I don't think he's like genuinely kind of criticizing the work. He just likes to see.
I think it's also like he has trouble making his movies, you know, Spike Lee. I mean, he hasn't been able to get financing for his last movie for a long while after his Katrina documentary. So I think he kind of feels that he needs to make noise to be able to kind of make the movies he wants. And I don't think taking on somebody like Clint Eastwood, who's like the darling of Hollywood, a filmmaker that I per se don't really care that much about.
No, I'm not massive.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I liked him as an actor, but even, I mean, you know, like that old thing that Sergio Leone always said, that Clint Eastwood has two expressions, one with a hat and one without a hat. So, I don't think Spike Lee taking him on was a smart idea. But also, I think what you were mentioning about Vincent Gallo and a lot, like what Harmony Korine is saying about Quentin Tarantino is like, I mean, guys, isn't there some, like, a tinge of jealousy in your disses, you know? Like, because Quentin Tarantino is, like, one of the most popular film directors at the moment, you know? He's, like, one of the highly regarded ones. And I know Martin has his issues with him, but I love the guy, man. I watch his movies religiously, I would say.
I don't think that one in particular, the Harmony Korine one. I mean, it's not really an out and out sort of diss, is it? It's a bit more kind of constructive than that.
Yeah.
But I'm just reading the last one as well. Uwe Boll on Michael Bay. I'm not a fucking retard like Michael Bay.
Yeah.
What kind of yardstick is that to like judge yourself against?
Yeah.
Secondly, you are. Like, even more so, which is like, it's hilarious. I can't believe you said that.
Although I feel that the Uwe Boll quote is probably part of a longer rant, which I want to read actually the whole rant, because it's probably an interesting one.
I mean, I think I was just going to say, my thing with Tarantino, by the way, there's a little bit of what Harmony Korine says there, in that I just get the sense with Tarantino sometimes that he is just obsessed with doing, you know, instead of like painting by numbers, he just does filmmaking by numbers, and it's just a conscious effort to go, right, I've seen literally so many fucking more films than any of you, and I'm going to prove it to you beyond all recognition, and you'll have no clue how many films I'm referencing, why I'm doing it, la la la. And I think sometimes it's a cop out, and it's easy for him to do. And I think he doesn't always produce films that actually deserve the praise that they get, quite frankly. And like Kill Bill, both of them, that's for me, that's just sort of like the highlight of that, basically.
It's interesting you should say that, because like we were talking about J.J. Abrams before, and how he's kind of made a virtual sort of shot-by-shot recreation of like the Spielberg era, where you can't see his kind of own fingerprints on the work. I think like Tarantino's this kind of opposite of that. You know, he's got he does obviously reference all these kind of diverse films, but I still think you can see like his style like sort of shining through. And I think that even though
I agree with that, yeah.
But I think there's, even though he brings in all these kind of really sort of obscure and, you know, like, I always kind of, do you know DJ Shadow?
Yeah.
I always kind of, I think he's the kind of, Tarantino's the kind of cinematic equivalent of him, where he kind of, it's like a cut and paste job, but he's able to like forge something out of it that is like unique to him as well.
Yeah.
And but I think that in the middle of that, there's always a kind of an emotional like resonance as well, even in the Kill Bill film. So I kind of understand what you're saying, but I think that there's more to him than just kind of a sort of homage machine, if you will.
And I think that interest, that criticism of Tarantino is very interesting, because it's the one that comes back all the time, and I think it's not valid, because you always compare him to somebody like Scorsese or Spielberg, when these guys did exactly the same thing. Martin Scorsese references so many of the movies that he's seen, and Spielberg and George Lucas more than anything. I mean, the whole of Star Wars, the whole of Indiana Jones is complete rip-offs of Flash Gordon and movies that they grew up with. And it's to the same style, shot for shot, they've copied stuff, and it's just because we haven't seen these movies, and they're not one of us, you know? Like, Scorsese was already a mature filmmaker when we started watching movies. Tarantino made movies when we were old enough to be snarky about it. And when you reference something like Kill Bill, he is using those tropes of kung fu movies, but he is also making a movie that's not... He's remaking a movie that's not supposed to say that much either. You know what I mean? Kung Fu movies aren't very deep movies with a whole moral background. So, I mean, if he's entertaining with Kill Bill, I think he's still doing a lot more than the source material did. And I think adding to that is already a lot more. And I think what he did with Inglourious Basterds, which wasn't a movie with overt film references, and all of the criticism that a lot of people had, I feel Inglourious Basterds had none of that, and is probably, I think, one of his biggest box office successes that he's made in terms of numbers. And you can say that it's because of the star cast that it was attached, that you had Brad Pitt to it, but I do feel he's a great filmmaker, and I always look forward to his work. Whereas somebody like Scorsese, I'm sometimes meh about, you know? He has his ups and downs lately. He's made his classic movies, but lately, it's been a lot of up and down. You know what I mean?
Is that your rant finished? I mean, the thing is, the thing that I would say, I agree with a lot of that, obviously. But then, if you mention that Inglourious Basterds was like his biggest grossing film since, you know, whenever, then I think that certainly, with regards to the two Kill Bill films, arguably that just proves my point. Maybe people were tired of it, and maybe they were not interested in just like some, you know, glorified homage to lots of films and genres that people don't really know anything about or care about. So yeah, I mean, I really liked Inglourious Basterds. It's a really good film, and it's probably better than Jackie Brown.
Yeah, but so. Inglourious was like 15 years in the making, you know. It took him so long to make it. I think he wanted to make it straight after Pulp Fiction or something like that.
I mean, without trying to turn this into like Tarantino special.
Which we should do. We should do a Tarantino special.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
I think Inglourious Basterds, I really like it, but I think there's probably quite a lot of kind of homage in there, but it's referencing like sort of films that are even obscure. You know, I think there's probably a lot of European homages in that film that that a lot of people aren't aware of. Because I mean, he's kind of his back catalogue of like, his knowledge of like cinema is just like unbeatable. You know, if you hear him talk sometimes and he's sort of rattling off like all these Italian sort of films that I've never even heard. You know, I've considered myself quite well versed in all cinema, but he's just rattling off these kind of subgenres and films that I've never even heard of. And you know, his favorite actors from that period and like who didn't work. It's like another world. So I think there are probably a lot more kind of nods to films in that than you realize. But yeah, it's and I think that's what maybe why it works as well, because people aren't aware of kind of the films he's referencing, perhaps. Yeah.
And also, Inglourious Basterd was kind of a remake, right? I mean, I think it was an old Italian movie, like you mentioned.
To be honest, I think it was just the name that he took.
Oh,
really.
Was it? Okay.
And I think it was the name and the kind of it was like a ragtag team of American commandos, but that was it.
Yeah. Well, in any case, there's a very interesting video that I uploaded with our episode 31, which was called "It's a Copy." Which was specifically about remakes, adaptations, and straight lifts, specifically in the Bollywood movies. But it was called Everything is a Remix, and they put every shot of Kill Bill that references an older movie. So you can just watch it on Vimeo, or you can go to episode 31, and it's in there on our blog on upodcasting.com. I think we can wrap up this part of the show. What else do we talk about? I just want to check with Adam, man. You saw quite a few recent movies, right? I want to just get some recent content in there, because you saw Cowboys and Aliens, right?
Yeah. I'll keep these very brief, obviously, because
I haven't seen it. It.
So we can spoil it for everybody else, but not amongst ourselves.
Yeah,
like.
Exactly. Of course, we're important. Our audience isn't. Yeah.
Don't worry, I won't spoil it for anyone. Don't worry. It was the same regards to kind of Super 8. I mean, it's an entertaining enough film, but it's just for what the kind of people behind it and what it's doing. It should be like the film of the summer, Cowboys and Aliens, and it just doesn't quite sort of reach that. I mean, I know there's a lot of people that are really kind of down on it. It hasn't had great reviews in America, and I'm just reading the ones from this country at the moment, and you know, everyone's saying it's terrible. The guys on Slash Film was listening today, and he hated it. Dave Chen, he was kind of like, you know, he was upset at the fact that he had to kind of take 2 hours out of his life to watch it. I mean, that's a bit harsh. It's not a terrible film by any means, but it's just distinctly average. And predictable in terms of like the again predictable with the aliens and yeah.
Well, I find it funny. What do people expect from a movie called Cowboys and Aliens?
You know? Well, yeah, that's true.
I mean, I wouldn't set the bar very high. I think a lot of people were just disappointed with Jon Favreau, because like J.J. Abrams, he's one of those guys that almost gets a pass from the film geek world. You know, he's one of the favorite guys. So we just kind of even. If and I think we're quoting the same episode of the Slash Filmcast where I think Devendra said that they saw it at Comic Con or something, and he had never seen so many disappointed geeks in one place ever as they saw. And I think the last time this happened was in The Last Airbender.
Jeez. So, no, I mean, it's kind of simple kind of premise, isn't it? Really. And I bet that, you know, studio executives must love that one. You know, they go to pitch a meeting and it's like, okay, it's cowboys and aliens.
Yeah, it's, you know, gold.
they must love that. But yeah, I think what you're saying about it being a simple idea, I mean, definitely. But if you've got that, you need to kind of do something within it to kind of set it aside. You know, you can say, okay, all right, we're using these two sort of different genres and bring them together. Show me something different within those. You know, don't sort of churn out the same old kind of cliched cowboy stuff and then the alien.
And also, especially with the cast that they have involved, I guess, right? I mean, everybody that's involved in this movie. Jon Favreau came out of Iron Man, which were huge hits. And then you have Daniel Craig. Harrison Ford is in there. I think Sam Rockwell is in there too, right?
Yeah, he's got a great cast. But, you know, and for the most part, they're pretty good. But, you know, he's an actor himself. So, I mean, he's kind of, I suppose, in a sense, he's expected to kind of draw out, like, decent performances. But, yeah, I mean, Harrison Ford's fun. His character's a little bit skew-iff in terms of kind of continuity. You know, he's, one minute is his kind of vengeful kind of cattle boss. The next is shown like his soft side.
Yeah.
Daniel Craig's good. He's kind of, you know, the sort of monosyllabic man with no name. He doesn't, and he plays that quite well. But you know, Robert Downey Jr. was meant to play his kind of part before scheduling. Well, you know, that sort of cliched Hollywood phrase, scheduling conflicts with yeah. Sherlock Holmes 2 kind of got in the way. And you can't help watching it thinking that maybe, like, Downey Jr. would have brought the kind of lightness of touch that the film probably needs, really.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so again, it's an average film where it should be sort of a knockout big summer blockbuster.
By the way, have you guys seen the trailer of Sherlock Holmes, which in my cinema was playing before Super 8? I don't know. Did you guys see it?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
It looks awesome, man. I'm really looking forward to that one. I don't know. Did you guys enjoyed the first one, right, or not really?
Oh, I love the first one.
Yeah, you loved it. I remember. Adam, did you like the first Sherlock Holmes?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you haven't seen it. Okay, cool. What else? What else did you want to talk about, Adam? What else have you seen?
Well, I'll talk about one more. I saw the new Justin Timberlake, Mila Kunis romantic comedy. I say new, it's not like they've been paired up before. Yeah, it's Friends with Benefits. Right. I don't know if you guys have heard about it.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to it, actually.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with my obsession with Mila Kunis.
Well, it will do now. It will do now when you see this. But yeah, I mean, it works on... I've never seen that one from earlier this year, No Strings Attached, with Natalie Portman and Ashton Kutcher.
Kutcher.
I think it's just kind of really similar premise. It's a really similar premise to that, where it's kind of a no strings attached couple that kind of end up sort of realizing there's more feelings than sort of just one night stands or whatever, or sex without emotions. But it's done really well. I mean, it's the guy. It's what's his name? It's the director that made Easy A.
Right.
I can't think of his name, that comes to me at the moment, but he knows how to craft like a really decent sort of comedy, and it moves along at a really great pace as well. You know, it never flags or anything like that, and you're asked to believe these guys are friends pretty much, you know, good friends pretty much like sort of 10 minutes in. You know, they meet each other at the beginning, like 10 minutes into the film, you're expected to believe they're kind of like solid friends that hit upon this agreement to kind of have this sex without any sort of without any complications, and it, you know, he really sells it to you. You know, you really believe in the both of them, and it's got a great supporting cast. It's got you know, Patricia Clarkson.
Yeah,
she plays Mila Kunis's mum, and she's right. Like hilarious. And Justin Timberlake's dad's played by Richard Jenkins.
Oh right, you know, the
character actor. He's really great. I mean, he's, I don't know if you saw Hall Pass. I had to review that early this year. He's completely wasted in that film. He's got a small part, but he's just like, you know, they just don't use any of his kind of skills at all. And he's really good. And also Woody Harrelson plays Timberlake's sort of colleague. He works at GQ. He's really funny as well. He's like this really, like, he's this gay guy, but he's really camp and kind of outrageous. But it never seems like a caricature, you know. He's really quite, you know, he plays it quite well. Yeah. So that, I mean, that was a pleasant surprise, really, watching that.
How was Justin Timberlake in it?
He was really good. I mean, I didn't particularly. Everyone kind of raved about his performance in The Social Network. I thought it was okay.
Yeah.
But I saw that film he was in like last month, Bad Teacher with Cameron Diaz, and that, he was very kind of one note in that, and he wasn't particularly funny. Yeah. And this film's kind of I've got my faith in him again, really, because he was very good in I don't know if you saw Alpha Dog from a couple of years back.
Yeah, I've seen most of his work actually. Yeah. I think he's actually pretty good as an actor.
He's good. It's just the two before this, I was just kind of a bit undecided, and it's kind of taken this for me to say, yeah, he's definitely got the chops.
Yeah. So I'm actually even looking forward to his action movie that he's making now. In Time. I don't know if you've seen the trailer for that. We've posted it on U Podcast. But it's this Andrew Nichols movie. You know, the guy from Gattaca. I think he's made a few other movies.
I've seen that trailer. Yeah, he looks good in that. I'll go and see that. I'm definitely kind of back on the Timberlake road.
Yeah, definitely. And I just love Mila Kunis, that after Black Swan, she decides to do this movie. That just kind of explains how awesome this woman is. She can diss Russian reporters in Russian, and she can be the crazy Black Swan, and then switch over to a comedic movie with Justin Timberlake. Yeah.
She's a feisty girl. I was at the press interviews for Black Swan, and she kind of, you know, all the kind of male journalists were sort of crowded around her, and she was like, you know, she was really funny, and everyone, you know, she was quite down to earth, and you could see, she's the kind of chick that all the kind of guys dig, you know, because she's funny and she's not like too shy.
One of the guys
type chick.
Whatever. One of the guys in Super Hot, exactly the kind of girl everybody likes. I think we can just go over to the final segment of the show then, right? I just wanted to quickly talk about, we got two images that got released. One was, and we just want to talk about the show, not too long. I'm going to post them with the episode, but The Dark Knight is continuing its marketing onslaught on us unsuspecting audience members. They released Anne Hathaway as a... Well, I shouldn't call her Catwoman, right? I think she's called Selina Kyle in the movie.
Well, that's the alter ego of Catwoman.
Yeah, but I think they're being very careful with how they're kind of marketing it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what did you guys think of the first shot of her? Do you think she's a convincing Catwoman? Adam, did you get a chance to see her?
I mean, I was a little bit underwhelmed. I don't think... I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with it. I was just... In fact, I didn't know what to expect, really, because, you know, it's funny, I dug out a picture of Halle Berry.
Yeah.
Today, just to have a look at, like, the previous ones, and some people are kind of criticising this one, but if you see... Have a look at the outfit, I don't know if you can call it an outfit even, but have a look at the outfit that Halle Berry wears for Catwoman, and it's just like, how that ever got through like development stage. It's just weird. She's got like, it's like hamster ears, and like it looks like a riding helmet, you know, like a horse riding helmet.
Yeah,
horrible.
I think they kind of played up the sexual element a lot more, you know.
Just a bit, but...
I think everybody wants to forget that movie, though.
Absolutely.
I think we want to... If we compare it to anything, we compare it to Michelle Pfeiffer, I guess, in Tim Burton's, although that was... Batman 2 was completely in Burton's world, so it was just going gothic crazy, as he usually does.
It's very different from that as well. But, I mean, I think... No, it works, because it looks like they've kind of kitted her out in a similar kind of... outfit to that of Batman's, you know, it looks kind of that it's been created for like a sort of
a purpose.
Yeah, exactly, as opposed to just like an aesthetic. But it was okay. There's an I really like, there's I don't know which artist it is, but there's some of the Catwoman comics, they've got her in these sort of big yellow goggles with like these little kind of ears which aren't too kind of noticeable, and that's a really nice design. I don't know, people are probably aware of it that are listening, but that would have been a nice one to go with. But then again, you don't know if that's like, if there is a, it doesn't, you know, there could be like another side to her outfit when you actually see the film, you know, this is...
But would that gel well with Nolan's Batman, you know? Nolan is really like something that's like so real, set in the real world, and he wants to make it everything so realistic. I don't know if that much flair would work in Nolan's Batman. But
I was going to say, I know what you're saying, but at the same time, if you can, if that was, I think it depends on the character as well, doesn't it? I suppose. But if you were going to kind of make her kind of this like streetwise sort of attitude, kind of punky character, you could get away with maybe kind of dressing her a bit more kind of towards that. But yeah, I think it depends on the character.
Yeah, Marty, have you ever seen an Anne Hathaway movie?
I doubt it.
Yeah, I was thinking there's no movie of hers that I think Marty has seen.
I mean, there's no real reason for me to watch The Princess Diaries, right? So.
It's a classic.
I don't think so. She's a nice looking woman.
You must have seen Brokeback.
No, I haven't. I've got.
Must have, I'm not implying that, you know.
That's all right, I didn't take it that way.
I did.
I think this looks quite sort of earthy, I guess, Anne Hathaway in that costume and on that bike. So maybe it makes me think it could be quite realistic.
Yeah.
When it comes out. That kind of... what they've done with her.
Yeah. I'm just kind of worried how much more we're going to be seeing of The Dark Knight Rises before the movie is actually out, man. I think I'm going to officially now switch off. This is probably the last time I'm going to be watching anything related before the movie comes out, or we get like a proper trailer or something like that. Because
I'm telling you, you got to go for isolation, man. Just total isolation.
Just keep watching old movies so you don't know anything about new movies.
just go and like go on a, like a Fellini bender or something.
Oh god, man, that is a bender for me. So the final thing, Marty. What about the new Superman?
I'm liking the look of that.
Henry Cavill.
I'm not sure, but I'm certainly a fan of the artwork and the mock-up there. I like the look of that.
He's looking very Superman-y, right? Like, the image...
He's looking sort of like heroic.
Yeah, he is. And it's kind of cool to see him actually do something instead of, like, just being there, arms crossed. You know what I mean?
I don't think there's anything heroic about breaking into a bank, you know, when you have to do so. I think that's...
Maybe it's a bank with like atomic weapons, and he needs to break into like throw it into the sun, and then like Solar Man comes out and he has to fight him.
Oh jeez!
But Henry Cavill. I mean, I think the test for him will really be Immortals. That's coming out pretty soon. I think in November, Tarsim Singh's new movie. With Frida Pinto in it. I just keep name-dropping Frida Pinto like she's an important actress. But first of all, I like saying the name Frida Pinto because it's funny. But she's also a beautiful actress. Has anybody seen Rise of the Apes yet? Or Rise of the Planet of the Apes? Nobody has, right?
No. Next week alone.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. And she's in it too. But Henry Cavill, he pulls off a pretty good Superman. What do you think, Adam?
Well, did you know that trivia fans... Did you know that he was originally auditioned for Bryan Singer?
I had heard that, yeah.
Yeah, he was kind of one of the he was shortlisted the first time around. So it's quite a thing to go through, isn't it? Imagine kind of hearing back from kind of Bryan Singer's camp saying, "Look, you didn't get the part," and you're thinking, "That's it, you know, my kind of that one iconic role that could really kickstart my career." You know, I obviously didn't get it, and then sort of 6 years later, getting that phone call again saying, would you like to come and audition? So, I mean, I don't know how many actors in the history of kind of Hollywood have had the chance to kind of do that again, but yeah, I mean, he looks good. And obviously, if like Singer had faith in him or was like interested in him for the first one, there's obviously something there that Zach, I'm blanking,
Snyder.
Sorry.
Snyder.
Snyder. Snyder. There's obviously something that Zack Snyder sort of sees in him. But yeah, I'm excited.
I would have thought that Henry Cavill's sort of like almost grateful for the day that he didn't get that role in that fuck show of an excuse for a film that was Superman Returns or whatever it was called. Yeah. Oh, God, useless.
Maybe Bryan Singer just thought Henry Cavill wasn't emo enough, you know?
Emo.
Because I'm probably the last apologist for Superman Returns because I actually still enjoy the movie. I rewatch it sometimes. And I'm not even that big of a Superman fan, but I like the kind of dark elements that he added to Superman because I just hate I just find Superman a boring character, you know? Like, he can fight anybody. There's nobody strong enough to actually kill him instead of that's like a small green rock, you know? So the story, for me, gets a bit boring. But at least Zack Snyder, we know he's going to put some kick-ass slow-motion flying in there, so at least we can look forward to that.
See, that's why Superman 3 works so well, because he fights himself, doesn't he? Do you remember?
Yeah, he does.
Mm-hmm.
He fights Tobacco Man, doesn't he? Which one did he... That was the Richard Pryor one, right? Where he puts tobacco because he couldn't figure out what the rest of the 99.9% was?
Oh, no, that's the third one. Do you remember? Because, no, it's... I'll tell you what it is. It's Richard Pryor, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he's picked up all these, he's picked up this like all this flying debris of Krypton.
Yeah.
And there's one missing part, and he puts tar in. Do you remember? He types tar.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
Completely sort of arbitrary sort of.
Is that not Superman 3?
That's Superman 3. Yeah. Sorry, I was getting mixed up. When did you say cigarette or did you say tobacco?
Yeah, I thought. Yeah, I mean that's why I called him Tobacco Man because he was he's fighting but Tobacco Man.
Yeah, tar makes him bad.
Smoking is bad, children. Cool. Okay, so we're all looking forward to Zack Snyder, right? Although, were you a fan of Sucker Punch or not really? Adam, I know Martin didn't see it.
I didn't see it either, but it's, there's like the majority kind of hate it, don't they? But there's a couple of people that have really got behind it. I might give it a watch. I might stick it on Love Film sometime.
I liked it. I think you should definitely give it a shot without, setting your expectations really low. I think it's a good movie, so yeah. Okay, guys, let's just wrap up the show then. I think we had a good one. Adam, where can people find more of your work?
People can find me on Twitter. It's adlow76, ADLOW76. And I write for primarily for heyyouguys.co.uk, as you mentioned at the beginning.
Which is an awesome website, can I just say.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And so you have
no bias there at all. No bias there at all.
And you have the Cowboys and Aliens review on there, and the Justified one too, which I read, but I'm going to reread after I watch the series again, because that's a good one.
I mean, I don't know. Have you seen Justified, Martin? Are you kind of a big TV watcher? Or
no, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I mean, it was the second series I was reviewing, but well worth a watch, definitely.
Well,
that's the Timothy Oliphant thing, right?
Yeah, right.
I do need that was on my radar actually, and it dropped off. So yeah, I do want to get up with that actually.
Yeah, but Marty and me were always going to see him as his iconic role being in.
Don't say it.
God damn. I can't come up with the name now. Marty, what's the cowboy thing? Deadwood.
Deadwood.
Yeah, Deadwood.
I thought you were going to say Die Hard 4 then.
Oh, Die Hard 4.0. Oh my 4.0. God.
Well, I could have gone with Hitman and made it even worse. Marty, where can people find more of your work?
I am at Martin Corley on Twitter, and obviously the blog, which is upodcasting.com.
Great, and you can find us on upodcasting.com. We'll probably be coming out with a few new episodes soon. We're doing something about the Hunger Games. We're doing something about Harry Potter and a lot of Bollywood too. So we've got I've got a huge schedule of podcasts that I still need to do, but they'll be coming. And you can follow us on Twitter, and we would really appreciate if you could write us a short review on iTunes. That would really help us out. And you can always follow me on twitter.com, Arsene Bernie. Thanks for listening, guys, and especially thanks, Adam. I hope you enjoyed being on New Podcast.
It's been great. Really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed
great. And next time we'll get Ahmed and Adam in one room, and you can get it on. That'll be fun. Okay, guys, thanks for listening. Okay, guys, that was it.
Hello, I was just going to say, and we're out.